Since you went away, Rosanna, yeah. to try and please me. You never let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar, and I don't see you anymore. I would not leave you in times of trouble. We never could have come this far. Mm-hmm. I took the good times, I'll take the bad times, take you just the way you are. Don't go trying some new fashion. Don't change the color of your hair.
Are in a position to ever make a donation, you can go to bostonbookfest.org and learn more about how to do that. But taking my treasurer hat off now, I just want to thank Ogie Ogas and Susan Rogers for their time and their being here, and I can't wait to hear this session. So thank you all for coming.
I first met Susan Rogers while doing research at Harvard on dark horses. A dark horse is somebody who achieves success, great success, who you'd never expect would achieve that level of success from where they started. Susan dropped out of high school to get married, and sadly, it was a very unpleasant marriage that didn't last very long. So she found herself without a high school degree, a divorcee, but her passion was for music, not for performing music. She never was interested in playing an instrument or appearing on stage. She was interested in the backside of music, the engineering, the people in the studio. But at the time, in the 70s, that was an entirely male-dominated industry. So here she is. She's divorced. She doesn't even have a high school diploma. She wants to go into this industry that's completely filled with men. And she found a way into the industry, and then she got a remarkable opportunity. Prince was looking for an engineer as he was starting his new album, Purple Rain. So Prince was her favorite artist, and so there was nobody on earth who she'd rather work with than Prince. So when she found this opportunity, she snatched it, moved from Los Angeles, the capital of the music industry, to Minneapolis, which is not the capital of the music industry. And there, she learned from one of the greatest musicians of the past 50 years about music. And even though she was trained as a technician, she knew how to fix the equipment, put tape machines together, set up the studio. But suddenly, Prince asked her to sit in the chair and to record the album Purple Rain, which is the sixth best-selling album of all time. And from there, she kept going. She became a producer, possibly the first successful female producer who came up from the engineering side. There were other female producers, but usually they were performers first, or musicians, or came in through another way. She even had a number one hit song with the Bare Naked Ladies. Then in her 40s, she decided to switch fields. She still loved music, but she wanted to go after music in a whole new way. She wanted to understand our brains. How does music cognition work? How do we feel this powerful sense of pleasure and connection from music? What's going on in our brain? So in her 40s, even though she still did not have a high school degree, she went and got a PhD in music cognition became a professor at Berkeley, where she taught students and did research. So a successful person who you would never expect to achieve such success from her beginnings. I've had the mixed fortune to meet many of my heroes over the course of my life, and frankly, usually they disappoint. When you meet a hero up close in person, you see their warts. Often, they've got bad behaviors, bad side of their personality. They don't live up to your expectations. Sometimes they do. Susan is the only hero of mine I've ever met who exceeded my expectations. She is a decent human being, fundamentally kind, always thinking about others, in addition to her immense creative talents and intellectual talents. And the thing that captivated me the most, and that was the motivation behind me approaching her to write a book together, was that when she was talking about music, she was always very inclusive. She made sure that no matter what your tastes were, what kind of music you liked, that your tastes were important and respected and valid. And her approach to music, when so many people are like, these bands are good, this kind of music is good, this kind of music is lame, not so good, not worth listening to, she could appreciate everything and show why everything was worth listening to. The reason being, because each of us has a different brain, and our brains just respond to music differently. And that sense of inclusiveness was very important to put into this book. And so I think Susan is a wonderful person, a great thinker, a great artist. And we wrote this book so that everybody can come together and enjoy music and feel good about their musical taste, feel good about their musical relationship, no matter what kind of music you like.
Well, thank you, Ogie. That was really unexpected because we didn't talk about how we were going to open the set. So I'm grateful to you for that kind introduction. So Ogie approached me in 2019 and said, how would you like to write a book about music? And I said, well, I'm not the one for the job because my students, one of whom is doing the audio up there in the booth up there, Jay, our wonderful Berklee College of Music students, they know more about music than I do. I don't have any formal training in music. But I told Ogie that what I'm good at is music listening, which sounds so funny because if you say to somebody, you know, I'm really good at listening to music, it's like saying, I'm really good at looking at things. It's right over there. Look at it. See, it's right there. It doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but it actually is a big deal. Record makers, the musicians are on output. They are performing. They're putting their ideas, their creative ideas, out into the world. But it's the job of the producer and the engineer and the mixer to listen on behalf of the audience, to be on input. We listen to those sounds. We listen to those blends. We listen to those performances. And what we're trying to do is take all these individual parts and ideas and sounds and things and craft it into a gestalt, a whole, that's going to cause someone to say, I want that. I need that in my life. We were just talking about this in the car on the way over. Just saying I like that. That doesn't lead to record sales. I like that is fine. You can say, I like peppermint ice cream. It doesn't mean you're going to work to get peppermint ice cream. It means you like it fine enough, but wanting means I must have this in my freezer at all times. And same thing with certain records that we hear. And when I use the word record, I'm meaning recorded music. It can be streamed or whatever it is. So we wrote a book together about music listening. Now, as Ogie and I piled material on the table, Ogie is a cognitive neuroscientist as well. I think your degree is in computational neuroscience, and he's quite brilliant himself, quite a genius. So as we piled this raw material on the table, material about music and records and the brain and things like that, we discovered that of all the ways in which we listeners can bond to a record, turns out there are different modules in the brain that can independently attend to this one aspect of a record and independently give you a treat. The treat would be, at first it's going to be opiates. Oh, that feels good. And then later, when you anticipate that treat and you get, you're successful at hearing it again, it's going to be dopamine. So opiates and dopamine are going to give you rewards from listening. The cool thing is, all you need to find is one treat. There's at least 7 of them available. One will do. If a given record happens to please you on more than one dimension, good for you. You'll love it all the more. There are many records in my collection, as I'm sure there are in yours, that I love just for the rhythm. And other records I love for the lyrics, and other records I love for other aspects. And Ogie and I discovered our taste in music could not have been more opposite. So we're both seeking treats, and our brains are generating these neural rewards, but from different aspects of these records. So our book is called This Is What It Sounds Like, What the Music You Love Says About You. In this slide presentation, we're going to go through the 7 dimensions of music listening and show you how they all come together to help form your unique listener profile. Your listener profile is as unique as your fingerprint, as your taste in fashion or food. Here comes. So a listener profile is reflected in 7 dimensions of music. 4 of these dimensions apply to music itself. They're the familiar ones that you know. Melody, which includes, let's include harmony in that. Melody and harmony. Lyrics, rhythm, timbre. Timbre is sound itself. The song Autumn Leaves has certain chord changes and a certain melody, but you can play Autumn Leaves on a lot of different instruments. Your choice of instrument would be the timbre. Those are the musical dimensions. The aesthetic dimensions apply to art, visual art and dance and sculpture and poetry and painting. And we assess music along those dimensions as well. We'll go through all 7 of them. Over a lifetime of listening, each of us forms a sweet spot where music sounds just right to us on each one of these dimensions. Let's start with the first one, and there'll be some brief music clips as well. You may recognize Howlin' Wolf up there and Ella Fitzgerald. So the first dimension is one I didn't learn about in school, but I'm including it here, and I'm sticking with it because I learned about it in 22 years of making records in the studio, and that's the dimension of authenticity. It's your subjective perception of where you think that performance gesture is coming from. Is that singer singing her little heart out? Is that bass player truly flirting on that bass? Is that bass player digging in and really giving us the passion that he's feeling down in his toes in this performance? Authenticity is described by scholars along a dimension from naive, meaning you have no idea what you're doing, but you're feeling it. You don't have any technique whatsoever, but you have the intentionality to express yourself with finger paints or clay or music. That's naive art. As we take music lessons or art lessons, we can progress to the sentimental, and that doesn't mean like maudlin or syrupy. Sentimental means you have so much professional training, you can express any sentiment, any emotion, even while you're not feeling it. But you're a genius like Beethoven, and you know how to write about subtle emotions. So I'd like you to listen to these 2 clips. All of us have a sweet spot for where we like our musical performances to be. Personally, I like those naive gestures. I like music that seems to come from below the neck, from the heart, from the hips, from the belly button, from the groin. I love my Howlin' Wolf, because when he sings, sounds like his heart is coming up, bypassing his brain and going, bam, right there onto the tape. But the other kind of performance gesture is that perfect technique exemplified by Beethoven or Ella Fitzgerald. When we listen to Ella, I want you to pay attention to how carefully controlled and perfectly controlled her performance is, and yet Ella's got soul. It's not to say that above the neck isn't deep, and it's not to say that below the neck isn't smart. Listen for where you think these performance gestures are coming from. Here's Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, smokes that lightning shining just like gold. Why don't you hear me cry? Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Oh, the late, great Sam Phillips, the man who discovered Jerry Lee Lewis, rest in peace, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis and Johnny Cash and all that, said of all the talents he discovered, no one was more pure than Howlin' Wolf. Now let's listen to Ella. Pay careful attention to which part of her body you perceive she's performing from.
Drifting, dreaming, in an azure mood, stardust.
Oh, so good. It's hard to cut her off. Personally, as I said, I like my gut bucket stuff. Ogie has a preference for...
I'm more cerebral. I'm more above the neck. So I certainly prefer Ella Fitzgerald over...
Well, all right. So we
more
all
Beatles than... I'm Beatles, she's Rolling Stone.
Yeah, it's always the Rolling Stones for me. It's always the Beatles for Ogie. The next aesthetic dimension is realism versus abstraction. And we could make the whole talk just about this wonderful observation from Nobel laureate Eric Kandel, whose work was In Memory. Eric Kandel wrote a wonderful book called Reductionism in Art and Brain Science. It came out in 2016, and it just rocked my world so hard. He talked about painting in the mid-19th century. So on the screen there, you see a painting dated 1803. It's from J.M.W. Turner, an English painter, who did what young painters and old painters of the day did. You take your materials to some nice scene and you set up, and what you do is you capture reality. And your job, your craft in your hands here is to capture what you see as perfectly as you can do it. We agree. Here's what he's seeing. He's seeing clouds and the sea and a ship, and there's a dock there, and there's people and there's rope and there's all kinds of stuff. And then somebody came along around 1840 and said, hey, check this out. And showed him a new technology, a little wooden box. Showed him how you could squeeze this bulb and poof, you could develop this piece of paper. And there you've got a photograph. And that photograph, that little wooden box of squeezing that little bulb, that flash went off, just captured reality in an instant. Shit. What are these painters gonna do? All this craft that they mastered, that little technology can do it better than you. Faster, too. I recognize that because as a recording engineer who came up in the 80s and 90s, I imitated the recording engineers of the day. I worshipped Mick Gazowski and Al Schmidt and George Massenburg. I worshipped them because they were experts at capturing reality, at choosing microphones, placing microphones, sculpting sound so that the listener can imagine, here's what it feels like, here's what it sounded like in the recording studio. They capture reality. But then somebody came along with this new silicon technology and said, hey, check this out. And with the computer mouse went ding, 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 perfect kick drum in an instant. It took hours to get a perfect kick drum sound in the analog era. Not anymore. You just go to splice.com, I think that's what it's called. You just download your samples. So a similar revolution happened in music. I don't have audio examples for you here because I've saved them for the end. Personally, I prefer realistic records, meaning, in our use of these terms, a realistic record is one that was made with actual physical musical instruments that we can picture. Drums and bass and guitars and keys. And you can picture it in your mind's eye. You can picture the reality of what happened in that room when those players played together. Other listeners prefer the abstract records, the records that are made in the box, in the computer, with virtual instruments that you can't picture because they don't exist. It's basically an algorithm. You're pushing numbers around to make this sound. As it turned out, my sweet spot on records is for realistic records. Ogie's is for abstract records. Can you say why?
I like patterns. I like to go places in my mind. So I don't want to be burdened by picturing some particular people or some particular instrument or some particular performance. I want to be free to imagine whatever my mind's going to take away. And so abstract music, frees me up more to allow me to create my own worlds out of the music.
Yeah, and that's exactly
what... But you're the opposite. You like to picture
I like to see what's actually happening. So J.M.W. Turner, when he saw his first photograph, unlike the other painters of the day, didn't say, I'm screwed. He said, I'm free. I don't have to capture reality anymore. Let this wooden box do it. Instead of painting what something looks like, I'm going to paint what something feels like. And he went back to that same spot at the Calais Pier and painted what is considered to be the earliest abstract painting. It's called Snowstorm, Steamboat Off a Harbor's Mouth. The date is 1842. This is what a snowstorm at sea feels like. Similarly today, with our new technology, our record makers can now work from the vision to the materials. In my day, we were limited by the materials. We had to work from the materials we had and the budget we had to the vision. But today's record makers can make anything that they can imagine in their mind's ear. So today, we can make records that do, as Ogie said, free you from the dominance of reality and better enable your mind to drift to new places. Here's the third aesthetic dimension, and that's a simple one, novelty versus familiarity. Some of us like our musical forms, just like we like our food and our fashion, to be familiar. Don't give me anything weird to eat. Don't try to get me to buy this weird shirt or get my hair in some new style. I'm going to go with the familiar. Why? Why? Well, my brothers are really into sports. I'm not, but they are, and they've always got the game on. Why would you watch your 2000th baseball game? You know how a baseball game goes. The thing of it is you don't know how this one goes, and you want to see it done at the highest level. So on the left side of this bell curve, our classic forms of music, rock, bluegrass, folk, gospel, reggae, bebop, jazz, are for those lovers who want a familiar form done to perfection. Let's hear Gillian Welsh with her partner David Rawlings in a classic style of music.
My first lover was tall and breezy with his long head down, but he gets a
Some of us like our familiar forms, and I certainly love Gillian Welsh. But my sweet spot on this bell curve tends to be to the right of pop music. I get a lot of mental rewards from innovation and style. Now, Ogie, this one might be challenging to you, this clip I'm about to play, because it's this kind of music you like. But let's just see. This is from the great Brian Dewan. Here comes. Yeah?
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah.
It's all right. See, a lot of people might say, hell no. His name is Brian Dewan, and you should look him up. He's a visual artist as well, and he creates musical instruments. That he's playing on his Dewanatron. Brian Dewan, he's brilliant.
Sounds up my alley.
He's a right side of that bell curve kind of musician. Now let's go to the musical dimensions that you're familiar with. Our melodies in all of our cultures reflect how we use our voices to soothe, to reprimand, to warn, to engage. We change our dynamics, we change our pitch contours to get our emotions across. So it turns out that our brain, and a bat's brain, and a frog's brain, and I'm talking to a Boston audience, so you know this, there's such a thing as hemispheric specialization, where there will be a circuit on one side and a homologous circuit on the opposite side that does something similar but different. Anyway, it's similar in our human brains here. For most of us, the left superior temporal gyrus, right above our left ear here, is processing information, words, the lyrics in a song. But similar area over on the right-hand side is a slower processor, and it's focusing on how our pitches and amplitudes change over time, which makes it perfect for processing melodies. It's processing the feeling behind that singer's words. I was on Here and Now with Robin Young recently, and she really got me, because she started our interview mentioning a song that I just love, Wichita Lineman, performed by Glenn Campbell, written by Jimmy Webb. Listen to this little YouTube thing, and if you're a melody lover, you may get the same feeling that I get when that guitar player comes in with that lead line. Here comes. Or not. Oh. Oh. You're supposed to go to it. But it didn't. Oh. All right. Well, if you Google Wichita Lineman on YouTube, WDR, it's a big band orchestra, and they play an intro you won't recognize as Wichita Lineman at all. And then that guitar player comes in with that opening line. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Oh, it hurts. I love it so much. We don't always need words to love a record. If you love records that are in a foreign language you don't speak, you may be a melody lover. I've got my Caetano Veloso. I don't speak Portuguese. I've got a Ryuichi Sakamoto record that I love so much. The group of women singing in Japanese. I don't know what they're saying. I have no idea what they're saying. But those melodies are so gorgeous to me. All right. Next is lyrics. Lyrics are really interesting because lyric writing is similar to inner speech, talking to oneself. Whitney Houston can say something like, "I need a man who'll take a chance. Don't you want to dance?" And go from being in her own head, talking to herself, to talking to someone else. The word "you," when heard in a room, for all you know, it means "yo." But in a lyric, your assumption of whether or not it means you is never challenged. You can find out in a room pretty quickly if they're speaking to you. But on a lyric, it could be you. So lyric writing lets us, as has been said, don the clothing of the person who's singing to us and lets us imagine what it feels like to be a 17-year-old young woman, 44-year-old man with a bunch of kids, someone who lives in the South, someone who lives in the North, someone who lives in another country, someone who was born in another era. Lyric writing lets us adopt a new identity. When we're teenagers, it lets us try on the identity of others to see who we'd like to be. Nothing is more important in a teenager's world. This has been shown empirically in the laboratory. Nothing is more important to a teenage brain than understanding where you fit in your social circle. It's the most important question that you must answer. This is why we often bond to music so powerfully in our teens, because a lyric writer, a singer, can take care of us when we're hurting. When we don't know who to be, we don't know what to do, we don't know how to respond, you put that music on. That singer shows you, here's the attitude you're going to take to school tomorrow. Here's what you're going to say to that girl. Here's how you need to respond to your parents. Here's why you are justified in feeling that you've been wronged. What happens when someone takes care of us? We bond to them. All of us are going to have a sweet spot for that music that took care of us when we were hurting, when we were young. And love those bands and those artists that might be out of date now, but you loved them then. Oh, and here's rhythm. We'll listen to two rhythms here, and they're both from Berkeley students. So moving in sync to a rhythm is one of the earliest musical behaviors that emerges. Toddlers start to extract a rhythm from a song and they bounce up and down. I don't have children, but you've seen with Zane. How old was Zane when he started moving to music? Oh,
two.
Yeah, two.
not well, but he moved.
Exactly. Yeah. The little bodies, they don't have the coordination yet. They can't necessarily be in time. But what is that? That compulsion to, I hear a beat. I want to move to it. It's linked to our capacity for social bonding with others. Listeners have their preferred tempos. We like to walk at a tempo of around 105 beats per minute. A fast walk is around 120 beats per minute. It's comfortable to dance to music at 120, 130 beats per minute. So music that matches how our bodies like to move is generally our favorite. But all of us like to move a different way. You see rock concerts and you'll see the pogo stick up and down motion to rock music. Now, a more R&B soul music lover is going to want to do that front to back kind of thing. In the 80s, we'd go to clubs and you'd have that soul or funk or R&B music on the dance floor. And you're not going up and down. You're kind of going front to back a little bit. Latin music has a more side-to-side rhythm. All of us have our preferences, have our sweet spots. The first clip I'm going to play for you, notice it's got a very strong beat on the one and the two. A very strong up and down straight rhythm. This is from Jessica Galinas, Berkeley student. That nice four on the floor pulse that almost compels you to move like this. Now, this next clip is from Tiger State, produced by Berkeley producer Hans Norden. Note that the implied motion is side to side on this one.
I miss you. But you never, ever, ever have the time for me. I wonder why, baby. Yes, I miss you.
More syncopation in that one. Listeners tend to have a general preference for where they like their rhythms to be. The last of our dimensions is timbre, and timbre is sound itself. We form what psychologists call timbre templates for how vibrating objects cause a sound wave. So you're a little kid, and you're there, and you're in your high chair, and you got your plastic sippy cup, and you're thinking, oh, the hell with this, and you fling that plastic sippy cup, and it hits the floor. Dink, 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 dink. You're learning how a hollow plastic object sounds when it bounces. Should you get your little mitts on a glass and throw that onto the floor, not only will it sound something different, it's not going to bounce, it's going to shatter, but there might be a different reaction from mom. So you're learning about rhythms, you're learning about timbres, you're learning about the physical world and the sounds that the physical world makes. You poke your brother, you pull your dog's tail, you cause things to make sound. So you can form these timbre templates. The most ingrained timbre template that we form is the one for voices. Human beings, it's one psychologist has written about this, human beings had to find each other in the dark of the cave, ancient human beings, in the dark of the jungle or in the cave, and we often couldn't see one another when you're looking for a mate. You're kind of just groping around there, but voices were informative. The timbre of a voice tells us something about a person's age, their weight, their physical health, whether they're healthy or strong or frail. We humans, in our courtship rituals, put a lot of emphasis on voices, vocal timbre in particular. This is one of the fun facts I learned when I was researching this chapter in the book is that women with sexy voices have more sex than women with sexy bodies. Yep. And the more sex is measured by age at which you first started having sex, how many partners you've had, whether or not you've cheated on your partner. The women with the sexy voices rank higher on that scale. Who knew? Women, on the other hand, have strong preferences for male vocal timbre, although researcher Sarah Collins discovered that we know what we like it just has practically no correlation with the actual physical characteristics of a man. So just because a man has a deep voice doesn't mean that he's big, or a high voice doesn't mean that he's small. You get your preference, but as Sarah Collins wrote, she said, but what its function is really unclear, because it's not predictive. And I will point out that Ogie and our editor, Tom, were really especially interested in that part of the book. In fact, editor Tom said, yeah, I think you should open the chapter with that. we all have our preferences for our singers, and I mentioned in the book the male vocalist whose voice just makes me swoon. Last week, I was giving a talk to a group of gay men here in Boston who've been getting together once a month for 20 years. They have a book club, and they were really, really interested in the conversation on male vocal timbre, and several of them agreed that they too swooned over the singer that I loved best. There's just something about certain voices. This is why on record producers know the most important instrument you're going to put on there is the human voice. Voices sell records, and I'm going to point that out in just a moment when we get to the last slide. So here are how those seven dimensions are intertwined. If you're listening to music, the very first processing stage is going to be auditory scene analysis. Is there music here? Because often when we're listening to music, there are other sounds going on. You can independently attend to just that part of the signal that corresponds to the musical parts. You can hone in and focus on the music or not. So that's auditory scene analysis, which feeds into timbre perception. If I'm hearing music, what instruments am I hearing? What is that I'm hearing? It looks like a saxophone, vocal, and guitar. Okay, are they playing a song that I know? Now those slower circuits are going to kick in, and you're going to listen to that melody. Do I know this song? You're going to listen on that left-hand side to those lyrics. Are these the same words, or are they changing the words? This rhythm, are they doing it in a syncopated rhythm, or is it a straight rhythm? Is this the rhythm that I know? Independent regions of the brain. Surrounding all of this are higher-order circuits that are assessing the authenticity of the performances, whether it's in a novel or familiar style, and whether or not, well, in this case, it would be realistic musical instruments, but it could be just someone at a laptop playing a piece of music, in which case it would be abstract. So when you hear a new piece of music for the very first time, we automatically, unconsciously scan for where the treats are. Am I going to get a rhythmic treat? Am I going to get a lyrical treat? Am I going to get a stylistic treat? Where are my treats? Where are my treats? We scan for treats. And if you don't find any, not a single one, you might think, and you might even say, it's good. I like it. It's good. But it will never lead you to adding that record to your playlist. If, on the other hand, you scan and you find a treat you love, and if you find more than one, you have that reaction that every record maker wants. I want that. I need that. Who was that? Let me get the name of that artist. What was the name of that song again? You're going to add that to your playlist. You want to hear it again, meaning you're motivated to work to finding that and adding it to your library. That's with a novel record. When we listen to a familiar record, we know where our treats are. And we go right to our treats. We go right to our happy place. When you ask most people, what kind of music do you like? Most of them say, I like all kinds. I like all kinds of music. Of course you do. You're going to like some lyric writers. You're going to like some drummers. You're going to like some stylists. You're going to like music for different reasons. All right, we're nearly done here. We're going to have plenty of time for your questions. But let me quickly describe the last chapter of the book. The last chapter of the book makes a comparison between falling in love with a record and falling in love with a person. Turns out there's a recently discovered network, neural network in our brains, a network of nuclei that are involved in approach and retreat behavior and involved in a lot of things. But it's called the default network. It's called that because it's the network that gets active when we go into our own heads. Some of you are paying attention to what I'm saying. Probably 50% of you are in your own heads thinking about other things. That's what we do. If you ask people, are you thinking about something other than what you're thinking about right now or other than what you're doing right now, 30 to 50% of the time they say yes. That's a brain. It goes out, goes in, out and in. It turns out that music listening to music that we love is one of the best and fastest ways to turn on our default network. And as Prince used to say, and that says what? It says that the music you love is you. It's your private place. We listen to music, sure, in a room with others, but we process it privately. We can play, as we've been doing and will do in a moment, records in this room. Acoustically, it's basically the same thing to all of us. Lower level circuits, it's basically the same pattern of neural activity. But up here, it's a different record to each and every one of us, depending on where we find our treats or if we find them at all, what the record makes us think of, what it makes us feel, what it makes us want. The default network is something that we activate right before we get creative. It's a precursor to creative, original thinking. This is a figure from the book that shows the seven dimensions. It's not really quite accurate. The first three, the aesthetic dimensions, are just, it's one axis with the two extremes. The other dimensions, like melody and lyrics and rhythm and timbre, have more than one sweet spot. It's more, as Ogie says, it's more like a space rather than a single axis. But a given record, you see the little hearts there and the little record symbol for the record, a given record might be close to some of your sweet spots on some dimensions and completely far from your sweet spots on other dimensions, but all you need is the one to fall in love. All right, our book is there in the middle with that wild, groovy cover. This is what it sounds like. But if you like this topic, I can highly recommend Of Sound Mind by Northwestern researcher Nina Kraus, one of the world's, if not the world's, foremost expert on auditory development, children, and sound processing. And then my doctoral advisor, Daniel Levitin, who wrote This Is Your Brain on Music 15 years ago, and still does quite well. All right, now, Ogie and I are going to have a record pull. A record pull is where we would have them in the recording studio a lot. You sit around the room and you take turns playing a record that you just love for one another. What you need to do in a record pull is you have to, I'm going to hold Ogie to it, now I'm going to do it too. You have to say why you love this record. And you can't just say, oh, it reminds me of when I was in high school. No, no, no. You have to say something about the record that describes your sweet spots. The great thing about a record pull is you're getting an intimate look at someone's private default network. They're showing you where their mind goes when they listen to the music that they love. It's an intimate form of sharing. You're learning about your friends, they're learning about you, and you're getting turned on to some music that you might not have liked otherwise. Someone can teach you, no. The chord change is coming. Listen for that chord change. Or that lyric. That lyric is one of the greatest lyrics of all time. And suddenly you're going to love a record more because someone else took you to right where their sweet spot was and said, hear what I hear. So the first record coming up is one of Ogie's. And do you want to tell everyone about it?
Sure. But first I just wanted to say, before we wrote our book, we had a couple record pulls together ourselves just to kind of get a sense of each other. And I can say that we absolutely had nothing in common. I mean, we could not have been more opposites. But it turned out that even though that might have been something of an impediment for our friendship, writing a book, it was fantastic because our main point in the book is that you should never be a music snob because our tastes are rooted in this, in our brain, in our neural wiring, things beyond our control. We're born that way. We're acquired over our life. So what we like or don't like isn't a reflection of how educated we are, how experienced we are with music. It says something about just how we came into this world, who we are in the ultimate sense. So in the book, we often use examples where we show her taste and my taste, and they're opposites. The point isn't which one of us has the better taste. It's as exactly as she said, it's a chance to look at the diversity of different people.
Yes. Now, we were talking about this on the way over here. Have your taste. Have your passion. Defend your records passionately. Just don't make the mistake of thinking that your taste is superior to someone else's. They like what they like because it works for them. And it's that great variety of tastes that give us this great variety of music. Where would we be if everybody shared the same taste? So we're going to play.
We're going to play The Grid by Daft Punk. Why don't we go ahead and play it, and then I'll talk about it afterwards.
And it's only 30 seconds or so of each. Here comes.
I tried to picture clusters of information as they moved through the computer. What did they look like? Ships, motorcycles. Were the circuits like freeways? I kept dreaming of a world I thought I'd never see. And then, one day, I got in.
Where's your treats?
So, I'm a writer. I spend all my time writing. I like going into other worlds. I like creating other worlds, inhabiting other worlds. And so a lot of the music I like because it makes it easy for me to go into a make-believe world within myself. And so this song is, for me, very good at creating that. I like the fact that there's a spoken word. I actually don't like lyrics. I'm definitely not a lyrics person. Of all the seven dimensions, probably lyrics is close to the bottom. Changing a little bit as I get older, I do have more of appreciation for lyrics now. But hearing the word spoken elevates it in a particular way and allows me to react to it, and it kind of separates it from the music, and it gives the music a sense of hovering in space. And then I do like the electronic timbres in the song. They also create a sense of unreality, or at least not the reality that we're familiar with. I like it because it just takes me to another place and lets the physical walls of the world kind of dissolve away from me.
Now, I was being interviewed the other day, and the interviewer said that he too loved electronic music. That was really the only style of music that he liked. But he said, it's funny because of all the electronic music he likes, he kind of likes Daft Punk the best. Mm. And he was wondering if maybe because they've humanized electronic music more than other artists.
Exactly
have.
Right. And I respond to that too. I actually don't like a lot of electronic music for that exact reason. It just feels soulless. I like cerebral music, but I like cerebral music that actually evokes the emotion. Like Bach. Bach is about as precise a composer as anybody's ever been. Just precision, counterpoint. Everything is about as intellectual as it can be. And yet he's able to convey great passion, great emotion. And I think Daft Punk is one of these bands that, even though they are electronic, they always find a way to include the human vibe. The rhythms are not perfect. It's very subtle, but clearly their rhythm must be on some kind of drum machine or programming, but they've done it in a way that has a little organic edge to it, so it doesn't feel so computer. It evokes a computer, but it also evokes a sense of humanity, at least for me.
Yeah.
You know, other people might have a different
response. It's funny you should say that, because just as that was playing, I noticed when that keyboard comes in for the big crescendo, it comes in late. The performance is definitely late. But that is, as you say, that's a human
little subtle
gesture.
Touches like that, as if it's a real person and not just something that they're programming.
Exactly.
But that, that's... takes a lot of talent to do that. How about your song?
All right, so I chose, and I know that my friends in the music business are going to think she chose that, because they've probably never heard me even talk about it, but I chose Born on the Bayou by Creedence Clearwater, and what I want to draw your attention to, where my treat is, and it's a big treat. Well, there's two of them, really. One is the lyrics. I like the imagery that's painted of the South. These guys aren't from the South. They're not from the Bayou. They're from Southern California, if I'm remembering correctly. But, just like Gillian Welsh. Gillian Welsh didn't grow up in Appalachia in the 1930s, but she sure can take you there with her lyric writing. So John Fogerty not only takes us there with his lyric writing, but for my ear, that vocal performance. Now, my favorite visualization when I listen to my favorite music is picturing the band in the studio. And I'm seeing in my mind's eye a man in that vocal booth, giving everything he's got to that microphone. That's hard to do in a vocal booth. It's a rather claustrophobic environment. There's no audience there. You got your headphones on. How do you do that? I've watched it done for over 20 years, and yet it still amazes me when a singer can get in a vocal booth and sing as though that passion is coming up from his toes. Now, the rest of the record didn't impress me that much. There's no treats for me in the rhythm. There's way better bands rhythmically. No treats for me elsewhere. But in that vocal performance and those lyrics, that's my treat. That's all I need. Here comes. Because it gets you. As I was saying, you don't need a record to match your sweet spots on all seven dimensions. One will do it. Two, if you're lucky. All right, well, that's all we've got. We can turn it over to your questions if you've got them. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hello. I just wanted to ask, since pop appeals to such a wide variety of people, do the elements tend to fall in the middle of these seven aspects?
Great. Good question. The question was pop music. What's up with that? We showed you the novelty popularity curve. That's Berlin's famous bell curve of stimulus complexity from 1971, showing that most people like their stimuli, their food, their fashion, whatever, their music. They like it to strike a perfect balance between familiar items and novel items. Popular music is at the peak of that bell curve. If the y-axis is record sales, pop sells the most, it's consumed the most, because it has managed to, for this particular time, strike a just right blend of novelty and familiarity. So you might hear a Dua Lipa song that is a huge hit, and it might be, sure, I love her. It might be in 4/4 time. That's extremely common. Using bass and drums, extremely common, very familiar. So my brain can immediately ground this new record in other familiar forms. All right, I know where you're coming from. I get this. I'm not afraid of it because it's not entirely boundary pushing, but it's going to bore the hell out of me unless there's something new in there for me to discover. And that might be new lyrics. It can be new sound design, which is very common these days with our tools that are available to us. It could be a totally genre-busting form of writing, which certainly Megan Thee Stallion and others are doing. It could be a totally new rhythm, maybe. Dua Lipa might be in 4/4 time, but producers like Just Blaze and the great Timbaland, very good at changing our expectations for rhythm. So that's what's going on with pop music. The sad thing for music makers is how fast it changes. What's pop today, 5 years from now, is going to really sound old. Remember reggaeton? Kept warning students, don't do it, don't do it. That train moves really fast. Is there another question?
Hello, thank you. That was a really interesting talk. I'm interested in the idea of how shared experience is also a private one. I'm thinking of how in cinema, I think half of our time watching a film is actually in the dark because of the persistence of vision. We blink and we miss so much of what's on the screen because we're just seeing what we see in our mind's eye. Is there any equivalent in music? Are we over deaf when we're listening?
I'm not sure. Are you talking about the spotlight of attention in music listening?
I don't know what that means, but I mean, there is this concept in cinema where we're literally in the dark for half of the time we're watching the movie. So I don't know what the equivalent might be or if there is an equivalent. Ah.
Okay, I think I understand. So your description of watching a movie in the dark means you're deliberately shutting out all other stimuli. If you choose to watch it in the dark, you don't want to be distracted by anything else. and you want all the stimulation to be coming off of the screen.
Not quite. There is this thing, persistence of vision means that we are literally blind.
I know.
We're blinking, aren't we? So even if we're in the light, we're still not seeing everything that's screened.
Yeah. So is there something equivalent in audio? There are a lot of good parallels between audio and vision, and Ogi can also offer an answer on that. But one thing we know is that it's the salience of the information. So I remember learning in grad school that you can flash basic shapes on the screen. Let's say a red cylinder, blue triangle. You can flash them on the screen for as little as 2 milliseconds. 2 milliseconds, and ask participants, what did you see? And they'll say, oh, I didn't see anything. That was so fast, I couldn't see anything. But then you give them a multiple choice list of objects and ask them, well, just choose the one that you think you saw, and people will correctly choose most of the time.
But I have something I could... Oh, go ahead,
please. Okay, I was just going to say, but sound processing... happens so much slower. You need many, many, many hundreds of milliseconds before you even recognize what's going on. You need 200 milliseconds before you realize if something is loud or not. So it's a similar process, but the time is stretched out in audio. Please.
I don't know if this will answer the question, but it's very interesting, even if it doesn't. So what I find as a neuroscientist, what I found to be the most fascinating and cool thing about the way our brain processes music is that our brain actually has 4 different neural centers, 4 different parts of our brain that each produce an independent conscious experience. We're conscious of melody. The part of our brain that processes melody creates its own conscious experience, which is separate from rhythm, which is separate from lyrics, which is separate from timbre. So each of these we can be conscious of. We can focus. If we're listening to a song, we can focus on the melody. We can switch our focus to the rhythm. We can switch our focus to the timbre. We can control this because it's 4 parts of our brain. What's so wonderful about this is it makes music of all the forms of art that come into a single sense, so painting, sculpture. Music is the most engaging and compelling because we have 4 parts of our brain that are conscious at the same time, and those conscious states are overlapping. The only art form that is even more engaging is movies because it adds the visual consciousness to that too. There you're having at least 5 different conscious states all at the same time in your brain, which is why movies are so engaging. So I admit I didn't quite understand what you were getting at in the question, but the fact that we have 4 different conscious things means that we can, if we're focusing on the timbre, for example, we might push away the other things. But at the same time, we can focus on, this is what's so great about the brain, we can focus on all the whole song at once, all of its holistic thing, all 4 of these conscious states, melody, lyrics, rhythm, timbre, all at once, which creates that intense sense of pleasure and engagement that we can only get from music.
And I'm just learning more about, and I'm eager to dive even deeper into it, is our brain's concept of time, say, as a human concept. But you're talking about persistence of vision and in a single instant, we might be in between frames or something like that. There might not be anything on the screen, but what matters is not what happens in an instant. What matters is what happens to our brain over time, because your brain is keeping a running stream going of what just happened, and it's anticipating what is going to happen, and it's that running stream over time, forward and backward, that lead to our conscious experience of what the hell it is we're doing.
Another question? Oh, is there a microphone already? Go ahead.
I was wondering what you found most surprising or most exciting about working with Prince.
Oh, Prince. Well, you take, picture this. Picture a young man, sensitive young man, highly intelligent, grows up in North Minneapolis, parents divorce when he's young, has to live with his mom and a kind of a wicked stepfather who treat him very, very badly. This little boy is locked up in a room for days at a time. He's an abusive home, runs away from home when he's 14 years old, goes to live with his friend Andre, stays up all night, night after night after night after night, stays up all night in the basement with a little bit of cassette recording equipment and some musical instruments, teaching himself to play and write and sing. And this little boy gets a record deal when he's 18 years old, a 7-album deal on Warner Brothers. And this boy, after his first record, managed to convince his label, yeah, you don't put me in the room with a record producer anymore. I'm going to produce myself. And in short time, when he's 25 years old, it's 1984, he's done a semi-autobiographical movie of his life. And Warner Brothers said, yeah, this will be great. And it was. And here he is at the top of the pop charts, right next to his main rival, Michael Jackson. Now consider that Michael Jackson came up through a system with older brothers and a dad that groomed him from age 5 to be a pop star, with Berry Gordy of Motown, with Diana Ross and the Supremes. A system that made Michael Jackson who he is. Michael Jackson was Man of War. Prince was Seabiscuit. Prince got to the same place on his own. So take this young person who's intelligent and sensitive. Where does he get the self-discipline to have employees? Where does he get the wherewithal to tell his management, guys who are in their 50s, what they should be doing for him, and his operations manager who's in his 40s, here's what I need you to do for me today? How do you do that with no guidance whatsoever, just relying on your own innate intelligence and instincts? I like to think of Prince as, you know, there's that concept in physics of escape velocity, and his youth drew that slingshot back so far with so much pressure that when it was released and he was able to start his life as an 18-year-old, that escape velocity was achieved and he was launched into the stratosphere of stardom. And on top of all that, he was good to people. He was a decent, good man. He had his flaws, but I will always love and respect him and always say yes to opportunities to be interviewed about him or to answer questions about him, because he deserves an awful lot of praise. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's all we have time for, sadly.
Thank you.
drifting. This rock got to roll. So I hit the road and made my getaway. Restless feeling really got a hold. I started searching for a better way. And I kept on looking for a sign in the middle of the night. But I couldn't see the light.
Chewing on a piece of grass, walking down the road. Tell me, how long you gonna stay here, Joe? Some people say, this town don't look good in snow. You don't care, I know. Ventura Highway.